Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Massey Bambara, North Bay Market President of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, and your chair for today's program. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download our iPhone or Android apps for schedule information and to register for programs. Since Richard mentioned a little bit of history today, I just wanted to remind folks that our founder, A.P. Giannini, was also one of the founding members of the Commonwealth Club, so the history of our bank with this organization goes really back a long, long ways. Today, we are pleased to present the Walter Hoadley Annual Economic Forecast, named in honor of the club's late past president and longtime board member, Dr. Walter Hoadley. Dr. Hoadley also served most notably as chief economist and vice president of the Bank of America. Today's program is sponsored by the Walter E. Hoadley Memorial Fund and Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Our program today features two distinguished speakers with distinct viewpoints. First, Dr. John Williams, President and Chief Executive Officer of the San Francisco Federal Reserve, and Dr. John Taylor, Professor and Senior Fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution and former Economic Advisor to Presidents Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush. Let me say a bit more about each. John C. Williams took office as President and Chief Executive Officer of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco in March of 2011. In this role, he serves on the Federal Open Market Committee, bringing the Fed's 12th District perspective to monetary policy discussions in Washington. Dr. Williams' research focuses on monetary policy under uncertainty, innovation, productivity, and business cycles. Dr. Williams was previously the Executive Vice President and Director of Research for the San Francisco Bank. He began his career as an economist at the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System and has also served as senior economist at the White House Council of Economic Advisors during the Clinton administration and lecturer at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business. Dr. Williams holds a PhD in economics from Stanford University, a Master's of Science from the London School of Economics, and an AB from the University of California at Berkeley. John B. Taylor is a George P. Schultz Senior Fellow in Economics at Hoover Institution and the Mary and Robert Raymond Professor of Economics at Stanford University. He chairs the Hoover Working Group on Economic Policy and is director of Stanford's Introductory Economics Center. Dr. Taylor's fields of expertise are monetary policy, fiscal policy, and international economics. He was senior economist on President Ford's and President Carter's Council of Economic Advisors, a member of President George H.W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisors, and senior economic advisor to the presidential campaigns of Bob Dole, George W. Bush, and John McCain. He was also a member of the Congressional Budget Office's Panel of Economic Advisors and served as Undersecretary of the Treasury for International Affairs. Dr. Taylor holds a PhD in economics from Stanford University and a BA from Princeton University. Today, Dr. Williams and Dr. Taylor will be in conversation with Dr. Edward Wasserman, Dean of the Graduate Journalism School at the University of California at Berkeley. Dr. Wasserman holds a PhD in media, politics, and economics from the London School of Economics and is the former executive business editor of the Miami Herald. Please welcome Dr. John Williams, Dr. John Taylor, and Dean Edward Wasserman.
Thank you very much for that generous introduction. It's a great honor to be here at the Commonwealth Club. This is the place where the wise and the famous come. It's their preferred venue when they come to the Bay Area. And we have, it's a pleasure to be able to be up here today with such two distinguished guests. We're here to engage in the time-honored practice of guessing at the future. Now, in earlier times, we would read the entrails of birds or throw the I Ching or enter a sweat lodge and wait for visions. But now we have much more sophisticated tools at our disposal and much more learned guides. The question before us, however, is the same kind of unknowable one, what lies ahead. I'm going to try to be be your proxy in this conversation for the next hour. And I'm assuming that you're not mostly economists, that you are deeply interested amateurs and very motivated listeners. So I will try to be your interlocutor. But I want to be mindful, and I will try to goad our guests to be mindful of the economic realities that our audience and our listeners inhabit. And their questions are real-life questions. Is this the time to buy a house? Is this the time to have a baby? Should I go back to grad school? What's the chance, if I do, that I'll be able to borrow tuition money for less than 6%? The reason, of course, that people have such respect for economists isn't because of their spreadsheets or their demand curves. It's because they are thought to have insight into how the rest of us should not just invest our money and our energies, but how we should direct our lives. And so what can we say then to sort of set the table? What can we say about the present moment? Well, it's puzzling. I think we would all agree it's a puzzling moment for those of us who are amateurs in the world of economics. We see a lot of paradoxical indicators. And I said overall, there's a measure of exuberance, measure of satisfaction that we're not in 2008 anymore, which competes with dread. The Dow is still one-third higher than it was when Obama took office, and yet the markets worldwide feel shaky. The dollar is strong. We think, oh, a strong dollar, that's a good thing. Mighty America, that means we can shop at a discount abroad. But of course, is that, you ask yourself, is that good? Well, no, it may be bad. Rates are low. Is that good? Maybe, but it may be bad. Oil costs less now than it did when I was covering the Wyoming oil patch in 1980. Is that good? Maybe not so good. Job growth is strong, 2.65 million new jobs last year, but wages are poor. So is this good? Is the employment picture good? Maybe bad. Our main international rivals look vulnerable. We used to think if our rivals are doing poorly, that's good for us. Not so good. First it was Europe we were worried about, the euro, and now it's China. Weak rivals, is that a good thing? Not so much. Maybe that's bad. So, you know, we have two outstanding economists, and I hope to assist them through a conversation that will be lively and not orderly. I'll ask them to try to keep their answers short. If you hear your partner saying something that you disagree with, please jump right in. So, let me open then with the big, hairy question. What worries you most? When you get up at 3 a.m. in a sweat, what is it that you're focused on that you can share with us? And let me just tell you, this is Professor Williams sitting next to me in the middle, or rather Dr. Williams and Professor Taylor on the end. Dr. Williams, what are you worried about when you get up?
Well, you just gave me a whole bunch more things I should be worried about. You know, often economists, people make fun of us for having, you know, two-handed economists. I think you had about 40 hands going there, so I think you are an economist too, Ben Hart. So I think that, you know, honestly, I don't wake up at 3 a.m. In a sweat. I think the economy is doing well. We're at, like you said, added over 2.6 million jobs last year. The data looking still pretty good coming into this year. So I'm in a pretty good mood about this, but what does worry me are things from abroad, like you said, what's happening in Europe in terms of their economic struggles that continue, what's happening in Asia and understanding that better, what's happening with the pivot of China from a basically export-driven manufacturing-based economy to a more inwardly looking economy with consumer and service sectors being a bigger driver of those economies. So those are the things that we're watching carefully, trying to understand, and I guess read the tea leaves or the entrails or however you want to think about it. But overall, I actually am pretty optimistic about where we are in the U.S. economy, and I think that we can weather some of these storms that out there that are happening abroad. But those are the things that are I'm pretty focused on.
Would you say, Dr. Taylor, that this optimism is widely shared?
I don't think so. I have to disagree on something. Actually, but, you know, you ask what I'm worried about. I'm supposed to later today go to math night at my granddaughter's school. She's in first grade. And I'm really worried what I'm going to say about things like counting and numbers, but it just reminds me, maybe I should tell a joke about the three kinds of economists. those that can count and those that can't count. But seriously, what worries me is really more of a sort of a longer-term issue, not so much the markets in the last few days, although we're all looking at that, but where the country is going on a longer pace. And I've been quite disappointed in the recovery from the Great Recession. Of course, the Great Recession itself is a disappointment of performance. But we just have had slow growth during that period. And this last year we just finished looks like it's going to be under 2%. The numbers just coming in at 1.7, 1.8%. So it's kind of, to me, a same old worry. Can we keep doing this? And while there's some good things to look at, I mean, this, where we are here in the Bay Area, is doing quite well. The unemployment rate's actually lower than the national average, less than 4%, 3.5, something like that. But if you just go 100 miles, to the east, Fresno County, it's 10%. If you go a little further north, Calusa County, it's 15%. If you go down to Imperial County, it's 20%. This is just in our state, right here in California. And that reflects quite a difference of performance in the economy. I think it all has to do with policy issues. Broadly speaking, we can come back to that. But in addition, if you look at the unemployment rate nationally, 5%, it sounds very good. But the number of jobs created, which again, millions sounds great. But if you look at the ratio of the number of jobs to the working age population, that's kind of a good measure to see how the economy is going. It's really no different than it was at the bottom of the recession. It really hasn't grown. So you're creating jobs, but not even fast enough to employ the growing population. And of course, we think that's because people have dropped out of the labor force. And the labor force participation rates have plummeted in the last few years. Great debate about why it's happening. Some people say it's just people getting older and retiring. It just doesn't seem to be that at all. A lot of it is younger people, a lot of it middle-aged people. So it's those concerns that I have, Ed. And it's again, it's really important for us to fix it for our country. And then if you look globally, I think it's important for the United States to continue the kind of leadership it has had in the past.
So policy issues, is he talking about you?
I'll let John answer that question. But can I just, I think John is right. There are a lot of issues that the U.S. economy faces. And I think that highlighting the issues about rural California versus the Bay Area is a great example of that. There are longer run issues that we do need to address. Education, investments, R&D, these kind of things are longer term issues. These are huge. In my seat at the Federal Reserve, we're focused on monetary policy and thinking about our two goals, which are maximum employment and price stability. So I got my tools or monetary policy tools. I can't really address some of these longer run issues. And I have to admit, I'm focused pretty much right now on the job that I have at hand. But I agree that I think our nation needs to be thinking really seriously about how do we address some of these longer run issues beyond whether it's income inequality, whether it's longer run issues in terms of productivity growth, the things that are really going to determine the standards of living that our children and grandchildren enjoy. But again, I was answering your question kind of in my day job, which is trying to help steer this economy to full employment. And
well, if you put your economist hat on rather than your hat as an official of the Fed, surely you would prefer a policy environment where there were more interventions available to government than simply the Federal Open Market Committee. I mean, there've got to be, we all trained in economics at a time when there was something called fiscal policy.
Well, there is something, it's still called fiscal policy. I do, and this is something maybe John and I are not going to disagree about as much, but we'll see, is that I do think that monetary policy has been forced to carry too much of the load in terms of economic stabilization in the last several years. And I think at times fiscal policy has worked to help, and sometimes has worked opposing that. But I do think we need to think seriously about fiscal policy in terms of a stronger, more systematic, transparent approach to fiscal policy that basically is helping, if anything, to help stabilize the economy during the ups and downs. What we've actually seen is fiscal policy tighten during the early parts of the recovery, and now we're seeing fiscal policy actually loosen up right at the same time the economy is doing better. So I do think fiscal policy is important. important part of it. And I hope that we can find a framework to think about how we can have fiscal policy be more systematic, more predictable, and maybe working more towards working in concert with monetary policy as opposed to in opposition to it.
Well, let me ask you this, and if we're talking about a more accommodative, a more activist fiscal policy, we're starting to walk into the sphere of political discourse. And we are in an election season. Do you see any indication that fiscal policy, or the obligation of the government to intervene in a more expansive way into the economy, is that going to be an issue? Is anybody going to bring that up?
I think so. They already have. I would say that, John, I agree very much with the idea of having a more predictable policy, and that would be an improvement. But you used the word policy forced on the Fed, or policies had to do it because nobody else would. And then I have a little trouble with that. I think it's more or less if one agency of government seems to be willing to do it, whatever it is, there's less reason for the other parts of government to do it. And so often I've seen, as central bankers have around the world, not just the Fed, have taken on these other actions, sometimes intervene in this market or do very unorthodox, unusual things, it's frequently led the other parts of policies to be stagnant. And you see this all over the place. I visited India early in the recovery, and the governor was saying, Professor Taylor, my government is telling me to do the same things that your government is telling the Fed to do. And you think it in Europe right now, Mario Draghi, the president of the European Central Bank, is constantly saying, you got to do this to his fiscal authorities, regulatory authorities, and they don't do it, so he ends up doing it. So in a way, central banks have, because of their importance and power, I think have begun to fill a vacuum, but the vacuum may be created by the actions themselves. And I think you really have to take that into account. Now, the other policies to me are much more than, as you call it, interventionist fiscal policies. There's a whole range of policies we need. I think on tax reform, to me, is huge. Our corporate tax rate is the highest in the world, as the White House and the Congress keep saying. Why can't we do that? Deal with that. Get it down. Broaden the base. Income tax, complicated. Can't we do a tax reform there like we did in the 80s? It would be very powerful, I think. And I think regulatory reform. I think, quite frankly, we want to do good things, but the regulations become so high they're a depressant in the economy. I think trade is another area where there's very real options for improving things. So it's not just interventionist, activist, stimulus policies. In fact, I tend not to think very highly of those. I think of these other policies were very important. They tend to be get the playing field right and watch out, this economy will do great. It's more or less that rather than we got to go in and take an action here and take an action there and fix this market and deal with that market.
You want to comment on that?
Well, you know, I still live in this fantasy world. If I don't talk about fiscal policy, Congress won't talk about monetary policy. So I'm going to try to.
You're among friends here.
Yeah, right. And the radio
hey,
listeners.
Hey, John, it's not just talk. It's do.
In terms of
you say you talk about monetary policy and fiscal policy, it's not just talk, it's do, it's the actions, right?
No, what I mean is I'd rather not opine about which fiscal policies we should or should not do. I do think, though, that the important thing is that in thinking about fiscal policy in the longer run, we really want to think about the longer run, you know, issues around growth. I mean, the drivers of GDP in the long run are pretty simple. It's basically labor force growth and it's productivity. And so John's mentioned the issues around labor force participation, and I'm sure there are issues around taxes and other policies that could actually maybe reduce some of the barriers to being in the labor force. So there are issues there that could be addressed. I'm not going to say which I think is better or not, but being at the Fed. But I think on productivity, we do know what the big drivers of productivity are. They are education, they are R&D, they are investment. So I would go to the principles that we want to think about in terms of tax reform. We really want to think seriously about what levers do we have that will basically incent and improve the performance in terms of those three drivers of productivity? And in the end, that's what's going to determine really the performance of a longer run performance of the economy.
I want to stay for a moment on the environment within which policy is formulated and come back to the reality that the presidential campaign as it now is in very premature, very early stages, I think, seems to be giving the greatest attention and to the anger and the disaffection of the portions of the electorate that feel they've either been dealt out or that the system itself is gamed against them. And I'm wondering at what point, I'm doing a bad job paraphrasing the people who are listening to Donald Trump and listening to Bernie Sanders, but they do have a common element of a deep dissatisfaction with the system. This probably is going to enter the economist world in terms of labor participation, in terms of the energy, the quality of the labor force is going to be available, and whether they can be trusted to do the work that needs to be done. But in the meantime, I'm just curious whether out of this unhappiness of the moment, do you see it, at what point does it begin to have policy impact? At what point does it is it manifested in the kinds of policy prescriptions that candidates think are going to win them votes? And, so, and then what happens if they do get elected?
So I think it will have policy impact, and the hope is it's a good policy impact, quite frankly. Right now, in some sense, I kind of welcome the recognition that everybody's not doing well. There's a voice, and it comes on the right, and it comes from the right and the left. The voices are quite clear. In a way, it's the things that I've been trying to say in my abstract way with these statistics. But here you have real people who are concerned, and they're expressing their views. So far, just in polls, there hasn't been any vote at all, so we don't know where it'll come out. But there's definitely something there, and I think that reflects a dissatisfaction that is based on real considerations, at least from the economic perspective, which we're talking about today. So the question is, can that feeling, which is not just a feeling, it's a real experience, be translated into an improved policy? I have my views about what the policy should be. Right now, the debate politically has kind of drifted away from substantive policy discussions, and it's fighting on amnesty issues, which are, I can't quite figure where. If you ever read legislation, you would know how hard it is to follow any particular line in that legislation. But we're sort of in that mode, rather than what's the broad policy proposals that you suggest, candidate, to get this economy growing faster, to get more jobs created. What is it you're doing? And we can hopefully have a good economic discussion about those alternatives.
Well, I agree on the issue that there are real issues around whether it's the stagnation or declines of real median wages, issues around the fact that as the economy is improved, it's not the case that all boats have risen. A lot of people have not benefited from the recovery. A lot of people in America today would say we're still in a recession. So I agree with all of those things, and I think people are giving voice to that. I do worry a little bit that sometimes the reaction is very populist, a popular kind of reaction of let's clamp down on free trade, let's go to more protectionist policies or those kind of policies. We haven't seen that yet, and I think that's actually one of the good news stories out of the recession, the Great Recession, the recovery, is for most part we avoided those kind of reactions, which were can be very, very damaging to the economy. But that is where I do worry sometimes with these populist reactions of let's just shut down all immigration, let's put up massive tariffs or whatever it is. I'm not picking on one or another, but those actually can have a pretty significant damage to the economy. We know that from history.
Well, you mentioned the R word, and so let me just ask you flat out, are we going to be sliding into another recession?
This year or yeah. Ever?
Well, near term.
I see it as slowing down. Some people call that a recession. Actually, the word recession is, for economists, means something very specific. It's roughly 2/4 of lowering decline in GDP, but it's pretty bad when you go from 2.5 or 3 to 1.5. And it seems like we're slowing down, and we just slowed down this last quarter. So that's what I would say. It's kind of more of the same, struggling. I think it's more struggling along. It's good we haven't had another recession. But I think with respect to other variables, it depends on the policy. You know, economists sometimes say, oh, we make a forecast. The forecast is always conditional on something. To me, that's conditional very much on the policy at this point. And we could have, who knows, it could be like John is saying, it could be a retrenchment, even more than we've had, or it could be kind of a revival. That's the big question. It's also a question globally. If you look at different countries, those are doing well and those are not so well. A lot of it has to do with the policy. It's the same story all over, and so that's what I would focus on. Let's get the policy right, and I'll have a better forecast.
On the concrete question about recessions, because there's a lot of talk about that, first of all, I think research has shown that recessions don't die of old age. There's really no evidence that the economy has to have a recession every 8 or 10 years, which is the typical, you know, average lifespan of about every 8 or 10 years we've had a recession. But there's nothing mechanical about that. I think that you know, there are shocks that have happened to the economy. There are things that can change the economic dynamics that cause a contraction. Right now, I don't see any of those obvious signs out there. There's always risks. There's risk from different parts of the global economy, but domestic demand in the U.S. economy is still very good. It's we're seeing a lot of good job growth. We're seeing good consumer spending, and we're seeing housing come back. So I do think that we're, you know, in a situation of 2 to 2.25% growth. Again, I see the risk of a recession probably being that of we would have in any year, of 10 to 15% probability in any year you could have a recession. But it's not that there's any real clear signs. And I'll mention something I think is kind of interesting regarding the Bay Area. Is clearly we're in one of the biggest boom economies in the whole country right now. You know this if you tried to take the Bay Bridge today, if you're on BART. You know this if you're seeing what's happening with rents for apartments or other things like that.
And you know it if you're trying to buy a house as well.
If you're trying to buy a house. And so I think that one of the things that I look for is obvious signs of imbalances. Is there something, you know, are we creating another bubble kind of Fed economy like we had in the 90s with the dot-com boom? And there's clearly, it's hard to predict the future. You said that. And you know, there are probably some companies that are starting out today that are not going to really be profitable and economically, you know, sound. But there's really no clear signs in the economy that we're just building too many buildings or too many factories or too many houses or anything like that, like we've seen in previous boom periods. So again, when I look, kind of read through the history, signs that there's a potential for a recession, you can see them in the data, and right now I just don't see any obvious warning, red flags, if you will, of a downturn. Again, I'm not saying that we won't have the ups and downs, and I agree with John, the growth this year is probably going to be, you know, again, more of the same old, 2.25% growth. But I'm not that worried about a recession this year.
The question from one of our audience members, interest rates have been held down at the lowest levels possible. How long do you think that such low rates can last? What is the likelihood of rates returning to 2002 levels?
Should I go do this?
Please.
Okay. So, first of all, we did raise interest rates, so they're not as low as they can go anymore. So we got a quarter percentage point on that one. Depends on, yes, one of the things I learned, John is one of my you know, teachers, is it always depends on how you plot the chart. It could be this or it could be this.
Right.
But I think importantly, the interest rate increase we did in December and our policy strategy going forward is driven by the improvement in the economy. Unemployment has fallen from 10 to 5%, which I think of as a normal unemployment rate. Inflation is still low, but that's mostly because of the collapse of oil prices, the strength of the dollar, some other factors. And so given that the economy is doing well, it makes sense that we're on a path to gradually raise interest rates. And, you know, exactly what that path will look like, how many rate increases we have this year or next year, it's going to be driven by how the economy is doing in terms of employment and inflation. But we're clearly on a path of moving interest rates back to a more normal level over the next few years because of the fact that we're achieving our goals of full employment and price stability. Now, I just want to briefly say, and this can get really wonky, so I will try not to do it, but there is a really interesting question about what is the new normal for interest rates. I mean, are we going to go back to interest rates of 2002, I think was the question that the member of the audience asked. And it's really hard to predict the future. We know that. But there's a number of factors that suggest that it's likely the interest rates in the future will be somewhat lower than they were maybe 10 years ago. One of them is just slower growth in the U.S. and global economy, demographics related to the baby boom and other slowdowns in population labor force growth, and some signs that basically global supply and demand, if you will, for funds is basically pushing interest rates to be a lower level than they were 10 years ago. I've done research on this. Others have done research in that, suggesting that, you know, a normal short-term interest rate in the future might be between 3 and 3.5% for the Fed funds rate. 10 years ago, I would have answered 4 to 4.5% the same question. Now, this is something that John and I were in a great panel at the economics meetings, and there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of disagreement about this. I'll let him talk about that a bit. But it is something that I think the evidence is kind of pushing to, saying that it could be that there's good evidence that interest rates may be lower in the future than they have been in the past. One thing from a policymaker point of view is I think of this as kind of like putting your trying to have your car on cruise control. We want the, so 5 years from now, when, you know, 3 to 5 years from now, we want the economy to be growing its trend growth rate with full employment and 2% inflation, and basically have the car at that point be in cruise control. And the amount of gas that's going into the engine that the car determines is kind of like telling you how much you have to do, you know, how much fuel you have to put into the system to keep the economy growing at that level. At that rate. And so that's the way I view kind of the what the normal interest rate is. It can be the interest rate that we learn tells us this is the interest rate we need to keep this economy growing on trend in the future. We don't know it now, but we'll definitely, I think the evidence is it's probably going to be lower.
So you say you want to get back to cruise control. I think that's a great idea, but my feeling is, why did you get off cruise control? It's been kind of a jerky ride. I think the Great Recession had something to do with that deviation from a pretty good cruise control. So I applaud the Fed for trying to get back, and I hope that's done in a deliberative way. But in the meantime, I think I want everybody to learn from that experience. It wasn't all that rosy. And cruise control, while it can be exaggerated, of course, we're not talking about a driverless Fed by any means. We're talking about a predictable Fed that businesses and consumers and people can rely on. And I think that's what our goal is. I don't think yours is different. It just could maybe take a while to get there.
You mentioned slow growth abroad. I wonder, there's a perception, there's a fear that some of our key trading partners and some of the more important economies are actually in a deflationary spiral. And that they are now their economies are entering a depressed state, not the technical definition of depression, in a depressed state, and they lack the policy imagination and the resources to do much about it. And so, in that respect, we're facing by this thinking, we're facing some very serious headwinds in terms of our own prosperity. You want to talk about that? What the global picture looks like and how that's impacting policy alternatives in the U.S.?
So I'll be happy to start, and John can continue. I think, first of all, that is the state of the world we're in. Global growth has slowed. China, importantly, is on a transition, a multi-year, probably decades-long transition to slower trend growth. Used to be talked about China 10% growth or above that. Now we talk about a normal of maybe 7 or 6.5. And in the next few years, we'll see that go down to 6, 5.5, and 5. That is part of their longer run trajectory. That is part of the reality of China's economy. It's a sign of the fact that they've moved up the income scale. And every country that's done this, whether Japan or South Korea or others, have seen growth slow over time. So I think that that's just part of the reality. That's not a sign that there's a problem or it's something to be afraid of. I just think it's part of the world we're in. And part of that is as China and other countries move away from buying a lot of, or basically importing a lot of oil and other commodities, that's had some pretty big effects on global demand for commodities. That's pushed oil prices down, that's pushed other commodity prices down. So it's created some of these forces that you were talking, disinflationary, deflationary forces. The good news for the U.S. economy and all that is that with all these headwinds happening, which are slowing growth, probably pulling maybe a percentage point out of growth this year when I look at my forecast, is that we have a lot of strong domestic demand. If you look at the job growth last year, in 2015, we added over 2.6 million jobs. 94% of those jobs were in either the service sector or government, the vast majority in what we call the service sector. The U.S. economy is the service sector, the domestic demand, the things that we spend really all of our money on. What are services? It's education, it's healthcare, it's housing. These are the things that really are the big part of the economy. Those are primarily domestically produced and domestically purchased. Those are the things that have been strong, they've been the drivers of growth, and they're the things that are basically offsetting the fact that in manufacturing and export-oriented industries, that they've been hit hard. So I see this divergence across the globe in terms of global demand versus U.S. economic situation, but we're in a good situation. We have a strong domestic economy, and basically we can offset that and continue to add, I expect, a significant number of jobs this year, expect unemployment to keep coming down. If it weren't for these headwinds, the U.S. economy would easily be growing, you know, over 3% a year. And of course, in that situation, a lot of these other issues, the disinflationary pressures, the stance of monetary policy would, of course, be very different. But that's the situation that we're in today.
Dr. Taylor?
See, when you look around the world, there's so many different experiences. And John talked about China. I agree, you can't grow at 10% a year forever. So 6% would be great. It's three times what ours is. I think that those changes have a lot to do with policy. If you look, South Africa, very great disappointment. Brazil is disappointing. You know, we used to talk about the BRICS. It's now just I for India. And so when you look around, I think a lot of that is the policy choices that are being made. It may change. Argentina might change. They got a new government. They might switch their policy. That'd be very positive. But coming out of the Great Recession, a lot of those emerging market countries did very well, surprisingly. They actually didn't nearly suffer like we did. That's, I think, their policy was pretty good then. But unfortunately, Brazil, South Africa, Turkey, to some extent, have drifted away from that. And China, it's really important that it doesn't lose track of the amazing reforms it put in place in 1979. It's, you know, 10% growth for 30 years, 700 million people out of poverty. They got to stick to that course, not sort of micromanage the stock market or the exchange rates, as they're trying to do. And I think if they do that, it's a very optimistic world that we live in. The technology is incredible. It spreads. A lot of people aren't doing it. One bright spot, if you look at Africa, South Africa is not doing well, but the broad swath of sub-Saharan Africa, 6, 7, 8% growth. It's 9%. So it's reassuring. I think if you look carefully at those countries, they've changed their policies in a way that's more inducive to economic growth.
To our radio audience, let me tell them that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speakers today are noted economic experts Dr. John Williams, president of the San Francisco Federal Reserve, and Dr. John Taylor, former economic advisor to four U.S. presidents. I'm Ed Wasserman, dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, and we are discussing the national and global economic outlook for 2016. I keep getting questions from our audience here having to do with inequality. And I think that might be an indication of a certain interest in the topic, and that interest may very well manifest itself in influencing the policy environment within which decisions are made in the coming period. And I'm wondering, since there is more wealth inequality, there is a problem of stagnation of real wages. The question is there likely to be a policy response to this? Is this something that you foresee policymakers entrusting solely to the actions of the private economy? Is this something where official policy can influence either taxes or public spending? And at what point does this dissatisfaction, which in my view has been growing, and at what point does it begin to have a real-world impact on the decisions policymakers make?
Well, I think the inequality issue is very vivid. To read about it all the time, it's best-selling books, it comes up in all the campaigns, it's definitely there. People have different views as to why. I tend to focus a lot on where not providing a decent education to a large group of people in our country. And this is something that I would address quite a bit more. I don't think it's the kind of thing you want to blame the very rich for this. In fact, they're doing some good things. They're creating wealth for people. You want to make it fair so that other people can be rich. And so they have the freedom. These poor statistic which worries me about our state. If you look at eighth grade math scores for Hispanics, we're close to the bottom in the states. If you look at a similar state on a border, Texas, Hispanic eighth grade math scores are one or two in the country. What's going on? Why can't we address it? I would just love to see some of these candidates say, we have a problem. in America. Well, we have a problem in California, and we can fix it. We can fix it if we dedicate ourselves to it. And there's lots of different ideas, but I think it is a problem. It's a very serious one related to income distribution.
Well, I agree with that, and I think education is the key. There's been a lot of research on this issue, and a couple things I would just highlight, because I think if you read the news or, you know, whatever, I guess no one reads newspapers that much anymore, but anyway, if you're getting your news on your phone on the BART train, the thing, there's a story out there that you don't need college anymore, you don't need the formal education, you can go invent Facebook on your own. The fact is, you know, economists are good at studying these issues, and there's been a lot of very good research on that. There is still an extraordinarily high return to getting further education, to get a four-year college degree. What's interesting, it doesn't matter so much of where you went to college. What matters is that you complete your four-year education, and then you can use that education, your human capital, to go and find jobs that are higher paying, that are available. So it's not so much about going to Stanford or Harvard. It's more about getting that education and getting that preparedness and that human capital to get those jobs. One of the things we also know from all this research is that technology has fundamentally shifted the demand for labor. So this is very much related to the hollowing out of the middle class. Technology means that if you use a computer, there are a lot more jobs for you, and they pay a lot more than they used to. If you can be replaced by a computer, there's not the jobs anymore, and you obviously, we've seen the wages fall. So the classic example, which people in this room may relate to, is the difference between an accountant who is who analyzes data, who loves spreadsheets, who loves being able to sort and work through the data and try to understand what it's telling us, versus a bookkeeper, which is basically replaced by Excel. So there are no bookkeepers really anymore, but the accountants is actually an area of growth and good pay. So I do think we have to focus on our education. I completely agree with that. One of the things I want to that worries me even more maybe than the income inequality, even though I think that's very serious, is that we are starting to see some signs of erosion of mobility, economic mobility. And, you know, because as John said, and I agree, the American dream is about, regardless of where you start, you have this opportunity to become whatever you make of yourself, work hard and be successful in different ways. And we are seeing signs that of an increase, more kind of like maybe Europe, of if you started in the lower income groups in your family, that the probability of being there when you're older is actually getting higher, as opposed to kind of a traditional American economic mobility, which is that there's a lot of movement between these different groups. If you started out in a wealthier group or a lower income group, you had a very good chance of ending up in the different group in your adult years. So I do think this is a huge issue for America. I do think education, and I would say pre-K, K through 12, post, college education, these are all important for tackling these issues. And I agree this is something if we don't deal with, it has really significant effects on the U.S. economy. We are not going to be globally competitive. We're not going to be delivering jobs, high-paying, good jobs for our people 20 years from now if we don't deal with these issues over the next 10 years. I just think it's the biggest issue.
Well, I agree with that. I'm disturbed by the fact that the question was deflected onto the lack, a deficiency of skills in the workforce rather than the nature of the jobs that are organically being created by the economy. It doesn't seem to me having a PhD will enable me to get more money if I'm drawing coffee at Starbucks. It's not going to help if I have a telephone sales job. And I think that these are the jobs that are increasing. If you look, and you will know better than I, but it seems to me that if you look at the nature of the jobs being created, they don't pay very well. And they're not paying a living wage because the work that's being done isn't worth any more than that.
So I disagree with that premise, but maybe John's going to join in this. But obviously, there are a lot, especially in the recession recovery, there have been a lot of downskilling of jobs where people with college degrees end up being baristas and things because there weren't a lot of jobs. But when you look at the job demand today for skilled professions, now my wife's a nurse, demand for nursing, which is very high-paying, very rewarding career, is very strong again. continue to be strong. That's true of a lot of other professional areas, people who are analyzing data, people who are using technology in the way I talked about it. I mean, a starting salary for an RN in the Bay Area is well over $100,000. Coming, you know, so this is a job. These are really good paying jobs, and they're very rewarding a long-term career. So I would argue that our economy will create the jobs for whatever our labor force it has. What we need to do is we need to have a labor force that is ready for that, because otherwise employers are just going to go abroad and hire engineers and other people from other countries who do have the higher quality labor.
Let me shift another question from our audience members. Low oil prices. How come and to what effect, and how much should we worry about that, or should we regale in being able to drive our SUVs even farther and more wastefully than ever?
John, you have an SUV.
As largely a purchaser. Well, I was reminded of a sports car I had earlier in my life. I'm now driving a Honda Odyssey, so I can take my grandkids around. It probably burns more gasoline. But there are people who buy gasoline and oil, and they like low prices, and there's people who sell it, and they like high prices. And I think that's what you're observing. It's a big change, and it affects some people one way and other people other way. Economists over the years have focused on the buyers, and the lower oil price is going to stimulate consumption. It's going to get the economy moving, and we haven't seen much of that as far as we can tell. It's really been this more disruptive side for the producers, and we don't know how they'll adjust. I mean, there is a cost of producing oil and getting it out of the ground, which is some sense of a limit. But basically, it seems to me, aside for these transition effects, it's good to get oil prices down. We've thought of all different ways to do that, encourage exploration and deregulation. So it's a good, but there's adjustments, and some people are going to be harmed. It's just, unfortunately, when, again, prices are good for buyers and bad for sellers, depending on when they're going up or down.
I think that one of the things that I'll admit to this is I think that the dynamic has changed a bit for the reasons that John said. 10 years ago, we didn't have nearly the amount of fracking or tight oil kind of production. And I think on net, it was this kind of this, basically, it's a, you know, lower gas prices is just more money in all of our pockets to spend on other things. And the dynamic we saw last year was that when oil prices fell, producers, especially in Texas, North Dakota, they cut back on production, investment, employment. And very rapidly, they adjusted quickly given the economic changes, and they're doing that today. So there's a dynamic to this which is a little different than deep sea drilling, where once you're drilling there, you're going to keep drilling for the next 10, 20 years, and the dynamic is just different. So we've had to learn as the economy changes, understand what's happening. We have a lot of economists who study this and understand it. I still think there's a positive about low gas prices in terms of consumer spending. We do still import roughly half of our oil, and that means that it does mean the more money in the pocketbooks for households. The question is, are they going to spend it? Are they going to save it? How are they going to behave? Here's a way to think about this question that I think kind of makes me think that it's a net positive. If you were to tell me oil prices are going to pop back up to $110 net to tomorrow and we'll stay there for the next few years, is that good for the kind of short-term economic growth? I kind of think probably not. So I view that the decline, we're going to see some further boost to consumer spending on that. But I do agree with John's point. These are global markets. This is capitalism and free markets at work. And when you get huge changes in technology, changes in global conditions, prices are going to move, and some people are going to benefit and others aren't. So that's really, I think, the primary story here.
It's interesting, John mentions how it's changed so much over time. I teach the principles of economics course to freshmen at Stanford, and it used to be, we talked about this cartel, the OPEC cartel, and this, all this power of these producers to set whatever price they wanted. We used to blame them when the price rose, and they'd say thank you when the price went down. It's almost such a competitive market now. The notion they're going to teach a student there's a cartel in that business is silly. It's a competitive market, and so we're going to see more fluctuation.
It's interesting to me, the conversation about oil prices has gone on independently of the question of the environmental harm that greater use of oil is going to provoke. And I wonder, are the markets incapable of registering that? Is that the pricing mechanisms of oil are oblivious to this larger movement in the world right now to restrict the use of fossil fuels? It's not, is that not an economist's question?
No, I think... I'm deeply puzzled. No, I think it is. I mean, I've talked to experts in the oil industry, have over the years, and when they think about long-term price determination, supply and demand, they talk about supply and demand like we all do. That's how we talk about everything. And they think about how regulations can affect supply and demand, and how that in the long run is going to affect these markets. So that's all in, I think, the long-term planning. What we're seeing now is a pretty sharp change in the current supply and demand situation. You know, we have a lot of oil being produced by countries that, you know, where there's geopolitical issues, we're going to see more oil come on the market from Iran. Obviously, the U.S. production is huge. So I think that right now we're in a situation in the short term where it's really kind of this market dynamic that's driving everything. You know, oil storage right now or inventories is at, you know, extremely high levels. We are in a pretty unusual circumstance in terms of supply exceeding demand, and we know what happens when supply exceeds demand, the price is going to fall. And so I think that's really the dynamic. But in terms of the longer run issues, I think environmental and other regulatory issues are very much kind of a determining factor.
Well, there's a question from one of our audience members who's worried about his or her investments, plainly. And the question is, do you think equity markets will contract by 50% because of China and overvalued VC investments? You can play with that 50% number. Is there some larger influence on equities to force them down? Are they sort of egregiously, is it possible they're egregiously overvalued because of outside foreign investment?
Right. So, you know, one of the many benefits of my job is I focus on the next couple of years, the medium term. I'm thinking about what are the fundamentals that are driving job growth, inflation, what are the factors that are really influencing where the economy is going to be over the next couple of years. Milton Friedman famously taught us monetary policy works with long and variable lags. It takes a couple of years for monetary policy to work. So I don't have a Bloomberg terminal on my desk. I don't get too caught up in what's happening with Apple versus Facebook or this or that on a daily basis. Try to understand what's happening more fundamentally to these economies in China, in the U.S., and other countries. So my own my own view is that there's a lot of uncertainty out there in the world. There's a lot of people trying to come to grips with how China is handling this pivot in their economy, how they're handling the liberalization of their currency and of their markets. So there's a lot of worry about that. But again, I look at the fundamentals where I see China going in terms of the economy. I see that still in a very good trajectory, slower growth reflecting some realities. I see our economy still having good fundamentals. So I try not to get too caught up with the market because those markets can move up and down and be volatile based on just kind of the uncertainty out there. You know, famously, Paul Samuelson said that, you know, the stock market has predicted, what, 9 of the past 5 recessions. And also, I would just emphasize something that is important. The S&P 500 or the Dow is not really that representative of the U.S. economy. If you look at the top 10 companies on the S&P 500 or Dow, I mean, these are really big companies, but they are companies like Apple and Exxon and Google and some of these other companies, which are being affected, I think, pretty significantly by concerns around whether it's commodity prices or about global growth and issues around that. And so if you look at the broader U.S. economy, I just go back, we're kind of a more prosaic, boring economy, if you will. It's more services, it's education and healthcare and housing and a lot of other things that's really where the jobs and the GDP really is. And so when you look at the stock market, as you could see with the latest announcements from some of these tech companies, it can move way up and down, really for idiosyncratic reasons. And again, as an economist, I try to take a deep cleansing breath, not look at my 401k. By the way, best advice I could ever give you, don't look at the statements on up or down, and really try to focus, hey, what's going on and what are we learning from this? Does this mean that there's something going on that we should be more concerned about?
Actually, I think there is an increased volatility globally. It's just not just our market, it's markets, it's exchange markets, it's capital flows moving around. And I think that's a difference. And I think it has to do with these very unusual policies that so many central banks are following. There is a sense in which the early actions of the Fed in 09 or 10 made the dollar low compared to the yen, and the Japanese come in and say, hey, we're going to do what you do, they depreciated the yen, and the Europeans have done the same thing, and then emerging markets. So those fluctuations in currencies, which do feed back into markets, it is a global economy for many of these countries. That's part of the volatility, which I'd like to try to get away from as best we can, certainly unnecessary.
I think the evidence supports that point, that for these countries, as John was saying, that have had their economic policies and positions have not been the best, not in good shape, they're the ones who get whipsawed the most when there is some volatility out there in the global economy. And I think that is kind of the market speaking to some of the problems, whether it's in Turkey or some of the other countries. So, I mean, I agree that good policies are really important on this front. I think that volatility is always going to be there. There's going to be some volatility. But my perspective, and I think John agrees, is that we shouldn't be adding to the volatility. We shouldn't be creating more volatility. We should, the volatility that's out there should be organic. It should just reflect the uncertainty about the economy that's always there.
I have several questions from the audience concerning immigration in this country, immigration in Europe. I just would like to toss it out there to see where you go with it, whether there's an economist response, if you're fearful that the situation in Europe now, the pressure on new immigration is going to result in unwise or hasty or panicked policies there that are going to have an influence on the economic performance. And here in this country, immigration still remains very much a hot button issue. I'm wondering if there's how you would weigh in on what optimal policy would look like, either in both here and in Europe.
Can I do the question about when we're going to raise rates instead?
No. Oh, I was going to defer to you.
I thought I'd give you a question you could answer.
No, I think some of the things you're hearing about immigration, the concerns, they reflect this problem with respect to the economy for many people. There tends to be you want to blame something for your problems, and people always are doing that. So to some extent, it's pointing to that. On the other hand, we do have a kind of a broken immigration system in the U.S. It needs to be reformed, and wish these guys could get together and reform it. Lots of different types of views about how to do it. But over the years, of course, you know, we are a nation of immigrants. We all came from another country at one point, and we all benefit from that. So we certainly don't want to go in that direction. But then there's the security issues, which are very serious. How are we going to handle that? I spent a lot of time, I was in government when 9/11 happened, a huge beginning of a lot of these efforts to deal with the terrorism, and it's still there, it's very serious. So we need to deal with that, but let's at the same time be able to distinguish that problem from the benefits that come from a sensible immigration policy.
I mean, I would just add that I think the U.S. economy remains one of the most dynamic, most amazing, innovative economies. And I think one of the reasons is that we're constantly getting the benefits of really smart, innovative people from around the world coming to our universities, including Stanford and Cal and many others. And we want to keep that that part of that process alive. And that's what worries me about it, you know, kind of a, not what you're saying, but an overly stark view that immigration is bad for the economy. I think it's clearly one of the kind of drivers of innovation and creativity.
Question from the audience member. What keeps many people awake at night is fear of debt, bankruptcy. How long can the U.S. keep printing money and increasing our debt?
So I'm glad somebody raised that question.
That,
sorry? Is that the question? I'm glad someone raised it because it is an issue. It seems like people are not talking about it right now. But if you look at the Congressional Budget Office, they're the group that is in Washington that's supposed to do nonpartisan projections. They have our debt accelerating into the future. Actually, they stopped reporting it when it got to be more than 250% of our GDP. It's too scary, they said. But if you project it, it goes to 700-800% of GDP. The U.S. will not be the U.S. anymore if that happens. So we have to address that. It's maybe in a state right now where it doesn't look so severe, but our projections of spending on entitlement programs are just exponential, and we're not paying for that. I think of my granddaughter again. What a burden that's going to be if we don't fix it. And so thanks for raising it. We tend not to discuss it enough, but it's very real.
This is an issue I think no economists just don't disagree about. We all agree that our federal fiscal position is unsustainable. The CBO, you know, is about the best you're going to see in government in terms of nonpartisan experts, whether it's whoever runs it, and it's always had this great reputation. And none of us disagree that we're on an unsustainable path. I think I'm an optimist. I grew up in California. I know that in the past, leaders of our country have come together. I think under President Reagan with dealing with Social Security reform in the 80s, other efforts in the 80s and 90s to take on these long-term problems, we've succeeded. So I'm still an optimist. I don't see it today. I don't see it next year. But I do think that this is something where we all agree that these issues need to be addressed. We need political leaders who take it seriously and find long-run solutions to get our budget back in order.
Well, let me suggest also that an issue that is ripening for public discussion has to do with the inability of a great many people of the baby boom generation to retire. And I think the numbers on per household savings and the size of 401ks and the insufficiency of any income streams that a lot of people are facing if they consider retirement, those numbers are harrowing. And I have not heard that come up in political discussion. I haven't heard it really foregrounded by the media. And I'm wondering, is that not a, sort of the monster in the box at some point within the next 12, 24, 36 months when a lot of people in their later 60s find, it looks like cat food. I mean,
the issue comes up a lot in thinking about the low interest rates. And many people pointed out, how can these low interest rates be beneficial when you have these people, their income has dropped to zero, and their life savings, and they're not spending as much, so sure the Fed is worried about it. But they argue there's offsetting effects. But it does hurt those people. And to me, what's worrisome is it seems like a broken promise in a way. I mean, I know it's not intentional, but they expected if they put their money away, they'd be getting a reasonable return when they retire. But it's near zero for so many people. And so it's another aspect of this, which is more than just the impact on the economy, but it's a real disappointment for many people. Actually, on the other side, I think we could be thinking about ways of encouraging people to work longer. Mm-hmm. I don't think people are living longer. Why don't you work longer? There's different things you can do with the Social Security, the payroll tax, but it certainly makes a lot of sense to me that just for society in general, don't make it easier for people to work longer if they want to, because older people are very productive.
I agree 100%. I mean, I think the principle that all economists have is we should have a system that doesn't distort our decisions. If you're 65 or 70 and you're still productive and loving your work, you keep doing it, and you're not quitting your job because the way Social Security or some other benefits works. And I completely agree with that. I think these are reforms that are doable. If you go to the Congressional Budget Office's webpage and they talk about how can we tackle some of these long-run problems with Social Security, Medicare, other ones, there is actually solutions. There's a spreadsheet. You can actually, all of you can go there and say, here are the choices we have. And you may disagree on those. But these are problems that we can tackle, and we can tackle, I think, in a way that benefits our generation and future generations. Hopefully that there'll just be more excitement about doing that at some point in the next few years.
It reminds me of the comment of the great jazz musician who'd gotten elderly and said, if I'd known I was going to live this long, I would have taken better care of myself. last question on housing. Prospects, predictions for the coming year. Do you expect the price levels to remain where they are? We continue to see steadily upward growth in housing prices. Anything you want to share?
Sure. I think that house prices have actually recovered amazingly well. So if you look at whether it's the Bay Area, but in more generally in the U.S., house prices are now back to or even a little bit above what I would think of as a normal valuation. Not where they were in 2006, because that was, a boom and a bubble. But their house prices have recovered pretty well across the country, including Arizona and even Nevada. Where we're not seeing the recovery still is in housing construction. We're seeing a lot of apartments built, and that reflects reflects, I think, some of the demographics. But I think there's still a ways to go in home construction. So I've been encouraged by the latest data suggesting where people are still maybe now getting a little bit more willing to get back into a house. They got scared by it because of what happened in the 2000s. But I still think there's a lot of home building that needs to be done. I got a 17-year-old, 21-year-old. I really want this economy to build houses for them. So they're not back with me. So I have a very strong, but I think that the demographics are that we're going to see more housing construction. I think the prices are basically now more or less treading water. They're growing basically with rents. So I'm not expecting further acceleration. In fact, I'd be a little bit worried if house prices kept growing really fast.
In the previous housing boom, you could point to the very unusual low interest rates as a factor. It seems to me studies have shown that. Some disagreement, but those low interest rates caused search for yield and excesses. I think now it's pretty much localized. I mean, certain areas are doing well. I would say too well. It's one of those things. If you own a house, great. If you're trying to buy a house, not so great. It depends on where you are. But I think it's more localized at this point. There's such a difference across the country, so that I don't see that as where the bubble is. If you think there's a bubble because of this unusual policy.
I think one thing that, again, I think economists of all stripes agree on is that a lot of these local ordinances and local laws and attitudes really are kind of the source of some of the problems with the housing bubbles. We saw this in the mid-2000s. Areas where it's really hard to build housing, basically what happens is when that economy booms, when the economy is doing well, you can't build any housing. So if supply is fixed and demand rises, prices go through the roof and you get that dynamic. So again, going back to John's first point, ones he's been raising, I think policies do matter. The policies that restrict supply of housing in areas are policies that also tend to not only make it harder for working class people to live here, but also policies that mean that when the economy gets hot, we see this incredible run up in prices because supply's not really responding. So it's just another example. The policy does matter, and getting the right policies mean that we end up in a better place economically, and I think for society.
You can tell that John studied both at Cal and at Stanford.
Well, folks, the time has come to bring this session to a close. Our thanks to Dr. John Williams, President and Chief Executive of the San Francisco Federal Reserve, and Dr. John Taylor, Professor and Senior Fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, and former Economic Advisor to Presidents Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush. We also thank our audience here, as well as on radio and television. This program has been sponsored by the Walter E. Hoadley Memorial Fund and the Bank of America Merrill Lynch. I'm Ed Wasserman, Dean of the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. That's right. We're plugged in.